Hey, I'm Christania, the girl with the big hair.
And hello from me, Alexis, the result of no strong father figure.
Welcome to the third episode of Community Pod.
In this episode, we'll be discussing what it means to find your community.
Although we read and hear about the LGBTQ community, those of us inside know it's not one huge group chat where everyone talks and wants the same thing.
We can't even agree how our outlawing Crocs comes on the fabled gay agenda. So what we're going to look at now is how we people find their place in our community. So, what did it mean to you when you first found your place?
So I was about 18 when I found my community online, which probably wasn't very smart because, you know, stranger danger. I made all of my old school lesbian friends on a website called Downlink. Some people call it Downlink. I met one of my new friends in real life at some bar in Soho, and we went heaven after. Retelling this story is hilarious to me because that night was an absolute mess. I met a girl who I'd been talking to, and then we started seeing each other, which led me to meeting her friends. And then we went to all the clubs and parties, and as time went on, our friendship group grew. Unfortunately, I'm not friends with any of those people now because life. But yeah, that was a great time, and I got my introduction to the LGBTQ life in the clubs, but via the internet.
To me, it was a big breath out, like I'd been holding my breath for years and hadn't even realised. In my teens, I was very goth. We're talking full-on black eyeliner, badly dyed black hair, and I'd been to places that played the music I liked, but I still felt out of place, like I had to monitor myself because it was straight space. Then I went to my first gay bar, and they didn't play the music that I liked, and I stuck out like a sore thumb. And then I found it. I could remember vividly going to Pop Stars, and they played Garbage and Placebo and Manson, and people moshed, and really excitingly, other boys with eyeliner and black nail polish were there, and they kissed each other, and girls with mohawks kissed, and we all danced. And my first night there was, it was like it was the first time I really could breathe. And so for the next 2 years, I went there religiously every Friday night. I was suddenly free on the weekend at Pop Stars, around people who were like me. And that was where I met my first ever boyfriend and my longtime Leszy Bezzy. Important people who are still in my life today, over a decade later.
Finding your community is not always easy for everyone. For example, if you live in the middle of nowhere with little or no access to social spaces where you can find like-minded people, it can feel isolating. I think those of us who live in a large city take it for granted because we have access to so many different spaces. You can venture to different events until you find the right space for you. I think that the internet has become such a powerful tool, so people can find their community with one click from the comfort of their own home. Not everyone is going to feel confident enough to put themselves out there and make friends without speaking to them online first. Some people are introverts, have social anxiety, or just don't like speaking to strangers in real life. So the internet helps alleviate some of the awkwardness. I moderated my first ever panel at our second live recording, and although I was completely and utterly scared, it didn't go as badly as anticipated, and I'm very proud of myself for doing it. This panel consisted of Mark Thompson, strategic lead for health improvement at Terence Higgins Trust, co-founder of Blackout and Prepster, Asad Dunna, director of communications at Pride in London, co-founder of the Big Gay Iftar and the Unmistakables, and motivational speaker Shah Bailey.
We kicked off the conversation by asking the panel why they created their own spaces. First, you're going to hear Mark talk about why he started Blackout.
We started Blackout in 2015. It was myself, Rob Barkley and Antoine Rogers. And we set up Blackout specifically to respond to the need for black gay men, because we looked around and we recognised that there was stuff happening, but there was very little which was specifically targeting us. And at the time, there were lots of websites which were popping up from the US, Son of Baldwin, Native Son, which were meeting the needs of black gay men. But we saw that there was very little happening from a UK perspective. Our principle was by us and for us. And we had a notion that if we build it, they will come. We've done a number of community events, social spaces. Our kind of tagline is join the conversation. And that's what we're constantly trying to do. We're really aspirational. We understand there are lots of issues and problems which impact on us as black gay men in the UK and around the world. But we want to come from a position of how can we work together to fix this? Way too often we are pathologized, we're problematized, and we want to accept that, but come from a space which was loving, caring, but was moving us forward.
Next, you'll hear Asad talking about why he started Big Gay Iftar.
I don't know if people will remember the shootings in Orlando.
In 2016, an armed gunman attacked a gay bar named Pulse in Orlando, Florida. At the time, it was the deadliest mass shooting on American soil. 49 people were killed, with a further 53 injured. The attack sent shockwaves throughout the LGBTQ community. People like us had been attacked and killed in a place that they felt safe, that we thought we were safe. We will never know the full story, but it is believed by many that the killer was a closeted gay man and had been struggling with his sexuality and internalized homophobia, and self-hatred were amongst his motivations.
I was in Calais and I was at the refugee camp, The Jungle. And I remember on the Sunday morning just seeing the alert and it's purported Muslim killed 49 people who are LGBT. And I just thought, I am so tired of reading the words gay, Muslim, with the words suicide, with the words killer, with the words potential terrorist. And I was just quite mute on that Sunday. And then we came back on the Monday and just thought, I've got to do something about this. And I've got to try and change the headline, because if I don't, then people are going to assume that if they're struggling with their sexuality, then that would be the kind of life they might have. So I called someone and said, look, I'm looking for a space. I'm having some friends around this weekend and we're going to have a little iftar. So the iftar is a fast opening meal during Ramadan, which is when people come and they break bread together. And it was Ramadan at the time, which is the 30 days of fasting for Muslims. I was having some friends around and I thought, well, maybe we could just go a bit bigger and I'll extend that invite to a few other people. So on Monday, I called a friend and he said, well, have you spoken to this person who's a priest? He has a church. By Tuesday, we had a church. And I thought, oh God, we've now got a church. We've got to fill this with people. So that, you know, that rhyme, here is the steeple, here are the people, all of that. I don't know all that. And so Tuesday, we had a steeple and we needed some people. So I just put it on Eventbrite. And I think I put it up as free or like £5, something like so non, if you don't care, you don't care. And all of a sudden we had like people in their dozens signing up. And then we needed food. And so I called a friend of mine who organized a supper club called Asma. So she gave the food. And then on the fourth day, like it's almost like God's making of the world, on day four, she called me and said, look, I really want to do it, but I need a bit of money to cover people. I was like, oh, what do we do? And someone from Pride in London called and said, look, we could donate a bit of money to this. That was amazing. So we got to Friday. I thought, oh gosh, maybe we should invite some press. So we invited some press, and then Channel 4 and Newlinad, they came down and covered it. On the Saturday, we had a church full of about 100 people who all opened fast. It was the LGBT and the Muslim community. And that was just amazing. Like that on day six, God created the Big Gay Iftar.
I'm a firm believer of if you build it, they will come. And both men created spaces where people can feel safe and interact with people like them. Next, we'll hear Shah talk about how she got involved with UK Black Pride and Gaysians.
I think it just got to the point in my life at like 27 or 8, or let's not put a number on it, years old, that I hadn't explored my identity in terms of being a black woman or being an Indian woman. I was very sort of white privileged, if you like, and I was very blind to what it means to be black, what it means to be Indian. And so I wanted to be able to utilize who I am, what I've created as a woman, not as a gay woman or a black woman or an Indian woman, just who I am. And I wanted to be able to say, look, this is who I am. This is what you can be. Because there weren't really any role models. There was the mother, Lady Phil, and there was Rita Loy. And when I put into Google, where are the black women and where are the Indian women, those are the ones who came up. And so for me, it was about how do I get to be part of this platform, because I want to be able to add value to the people who, like me, are just searching on Google looking for themselves.
Then we spoke about what people experience when they come along to the different events and the spaces that have been created.
They experience the most amazing black gay male love. I mean, they do. I mean, in a nutshell, people come along, and as I said, we do a range of events, you know, and some of them are online and some of them are in the real world, you know, and sometimes we piggyback, we engage with other communities, and we try to influence other people's work to make sure that the work and the needs of Black gay men runs through that thread. So we become advocates for the men in our community, for those that may not have a voice. But I think what people come along is that they can find a space which is caring and loving. I think that's the most important thing, which is, as far as possible, non-judgmental. And we were having a conversation earlier about the kind of notion of a safe space. And I kind of sometimes find that a little bit problematic, because I'm kind of just call it a space. But they can find a space where they can be themselves and be around other people that look like them, may not think, act, but kind of welcome them like that. We try to make sure that what we're doing provides education for men. So we have a line that we are here for the brothers that have survived without reading Baldwin, because those brothers exist, and that's really, really important as well. So people come along, they can have fun events, they can have enjoyment, connection, learning.
Mark talks about the ripple effect of how Blackout has inspired other people to continue this momentum.
I might be in Brixton or Peckham or wherever I am, and a young brother will come up to me and I don't got a clue who he is. I don't know him, I know he's really cute. And then you'll say to me, I know you from a Blackout event. Or I met my boyfriend at a Blackout event. I'm doing this piece of work because of a Blackout event. That is what people get when they come to us. And that's what I think we continue to do and continue to build. But ultimately, if you come to a Blackout event, you have a great time.
Hearing Mark describe how other people have been inspired by his events to go off and create new places for themselves is a brilliant reminder to us all that we can all play a part in building community spaces and projects and places that will bring people together. It can start as small as getting some like-minded people together to read and discuss a book or go and visit an exhibition, but just find ways to expand your community and build those connections around you. Asad then spoke about the experience of Big Gay IFTA and what it's like.
Food, really good food. That's like the driving force. How good can we make the food each year? So we've done three now. The first two were sort of similar. I think in the second one we said, can we make it a little bit bigger, and can we not do it in 4 days, but could we do it in 4 months and just take our time around it? And I think there's a real difference. And I think having a marketing background, you segment your audiences and you start to think, okay, who's going to come and what sort of things do they get from it? So as a second generational British Indian who's Muslim, that's quite a lonely place, because you've got lots of second generational British Pakistanis. They think differently. You've got lots of first generationals of Pakistanis and Muslims. So I started to think, well, for people like me, it was actually to meet other people who may have been working in similar industries, had similar backgrounds. A few friends came to the first one and it just felt very comfortable. We all sat on the floor. That was really important. People took their shoes off. It's all about kind of disempowering and taking away that. And that's part of what it means when you go on pilgrimage, which is everyone's dressed in the same robes. And so it was all about taking that kind of crap away that sometimes you get in LGBT spaces where people are wearing masks and a lot of them. And then that kind of carried into the second year. And then in the third year, this year, we did it in partnership with Iman. And for disclosure, I was a trustee of Iman, so you can see how it happened. And that was different because Iman caters a lot to the first generation who have moved over and have very different issues. Issues around asylum, issues around being a refugee, issues around being in the closet. And I think there's a fine line between where the first gen and the second gen are. And I count myself as very lucky to be where I am now, to be able to talk out, be it something like this, talk in a podcast. But I think that's what we've learned this year. And there were a lot of people who would be there and kind of never be exposed to other people, and the other way around, because sometimes there are spaces where you go into and you think, gosh, how am I going to survive in here? Or how are there going to be other people like me in here? So it's changed as time has gone on.
I've been along to Big Gay IFTA and I did have a great time, and the food is amazing. And I won't lie, as someone who isn't Muslim and awkward around religion anyway, I didn't know what to expect or whether I would feel welcomed, but I can wholeheartedly back everything Asad has said. The food was amazing and the easy conversation as people from different backgrounds literally broke bread together, the giant pride flag as our carpet, and we all found a shared kinship through sexuality was something I felt was really special. The event was obviously primarily for Muslim LGBTQ people, but there were a fair number of us who weren't, who just came along to learn, and I felt just as welcome and included. One thing I did notice is there was a number of people who quietly came and went through a discreet side door because they weren't out. I can only imagine the sort of relief and lifeline that events like this must offer to them.
I loved Asad's emphasis that Big Gay Iftar is all about the food, because who doesn't love eating a tasty meal with friends? Char goes on to describe how attending UK Black Pride makes her feel as someone that is on a journey of exploring her identity.
It makes me feel full. So many times where you hide yourself and try and be less black or not wear a bindi because it makes you more Indian. When you go to somewhere like UK Black Pride, it's almost like Charlie in the Chocolate Factory when he comes through those gates and he opens and it's like, it's like, look at all of this. All of this beautiful blackness has just been waiting for me to uncover. And it's not just about the day for me, it's about the relationships, it's about the sisterhood, the brotherhood, the protection, the real love. I felt so unloved by black people for such a long time. And being part of UK Black Pride, it's like a hug. It's like an embrace. The same with Gaysians. Having an Indian woman come and pinch your cheeks is something that, like, you see on East is East all the time. But if you're not exposed to that environment, you don't get to have that. So it's like being full. It's like, for me, it's about filling myself up with that love that I felt had been missing for so long.
That's beautiful, isn't it? That feeling of acceptance and embrace is so important. It's one of the things that I really love about being gay and about being LGBTQ. Mark then expands upon the feeling that Char described.
The way you described going to UK Black Pride is amazing. I think we all have that experience when we go there. It's kind of like when you might go to your first Pride, although it might be predominantly white or whatever it is. And my challenge for us as a community is, how do we make sure that happens 365 days of the year? How do we ensure that our young brothers and sisters who are in Wolverhampton or Leicester, in Luton, wherever...
Wolverhampton, yes, Stefan right there as well, thank you.
How do we ensure that we're now in September? Somebody's Googling that right now. How do we try to make sure that they don't have to wait until July the 7th, 2019 for that fullness to happen?
Mark is absolutely right and asked an important question. How do we create that feeling of fullness and family throughout the year? As the panel progressed, we moved on to discuss what it means for the LGBTQ community as it starts to become more mainstream.
Gay culture has predominantly been mainstream, commercialised for a really, really long time. And I'm old enough and long enough, tooth and enough to know that it's always been like that. And it very really has served the needs of diversity. Anyway, it's been white, cis, male for donkey's years. So I'm not sure if it's becoming more mainstream. I think it's becoming a little bit more television. It's a little bit more out there. We can pick up magazines. You can speak to your buddy and they're like, oh my God, you're my gay best friend. I really love you. Dope. All that kind of stuff. However, it's about what do those people do when the fighting really kicks off and it really starts. So what do we do as our subcultures? I think, what does it mean for our cultures and our subcultures? I think that should embolden us to be stronger and to scream and shout even louder, to make a stance, to stand out, to be even prouder and more bold in who we are. And I love the fact that a younger generation of queer activists, and not even activists, just actors, people are doing that stuff in their lives. I think what kind of worries me a little bit is that sometimes we, because we're particularly for black minority and ethnic, non-white cultures, we can very often put ourselves into even more silos.
I think Mark's point and question is a really valid one. Around Pride season, every large brand releases something rainbow on it. Straight people are using our phrases, they come to our clubs and Pride events. But all these people who are happy to engage in the surface level of our culture, do they really embrace our community or just the entertainment that they can derive from it? Drag Race may no longer be a niche show. Queer Eye may be back and there may be some wonderfully diverse representations of gay men on that show from all across the masculinity and race spectrums. But the truth is, gay is still used as a pejorative term. Camp is still played for laughs by straight comedians. And it takes a lot of guts and courage to be a feminine guy or a drag queen on the tube or regional high street.
Oh, well, we can all just go to the straight places now, can't we, and all just fit in. Let's just all be one.
Not going to.
I think that is where it comes from, isn't it? That is the straight mentality. Oh, you can sit with us now, it's fine. Why do you need your own space? And it's very diluting. And for somebody like me who is searching for those spaces, the more mainstream it becomes, the more dilute it becomes. So that's why I think it's so important for organisations like Gaijins, for UK Black Pride, to stand in their truth, to say, to put their foot down and say, it's great that you want us to sit next to you, but we need to have our own space too. We need to be there for the needs of our own communities and our own people, because it's not the fact that one size fits all. You can't solve all of everyone's problems with one magic pill, with one place to go to. So it's about exploring our culture, understanding it, and knowing that our community still need us, irrespective of all this going out there is great. And it's great to be included. It's great to be accepted. It's great to feel like oneness. It's very spiritual. But on the other hand, we still need to have that little part for ourselves, that little bit that still makes us us.
I couldn't agree more with Shah's point. It's great that LGBTQ people feel included in mainstream society, but there's nothing wrong with keeping something for ourselves. Navigating the world when you're part of a marginalised group is tiring, so sometimes you need a safe space to relax and be your authentic self.
I mean, I think let's be careful when we talk, when we think about mainstream, because when we think about mainstream, that is about kind of giving something up. All right. So historically, you know, if we think about, say, 20 odd years ago, Clause 28 was a very real thing in this country. And Clause 28 was pushed forward by the Thatcher government.
Let me jump in here. Section 28 was an infamous piece of homophobic legislation brought in by Margaret Thatcher and the Conservative Party that banned, and I quote, the promotion of homosexuality. It meant that no government or public body was allowed to sympathise with the homosexual agenda. For a lot of us, myself included, that meant that when we were growing up, our teachers in school were banned from talking about sexuality, banned from talking about our identity. There were many side effects of this piece of legislation, but one very real effect was that while many schools had anti-racism charters or anti-bullying programs, homophobia in schools was allowed to run rife because teachers at times felt like they had their hands tied, and legally, they did. It was eventually repealed in Scotland in 2000 and throughout the rest of the UK in 2003. But as with all things, the side effects linger for years longer.
It was a way of kind of shutting us up, right? If you kind of look at the history and the math of it all. And so that dies down, then they give us gay marriage. We get gay marriage, we get civil partnerships, they get gay marriage. So it's this heteronormative idea of normalness. So what do you see in the gay media, in the press? Lovely, nice couples going off. And I'm not dissing marriage. Anybody out there, I'm single, really happy to get married, and I've got a dog at home. I'm down for that shit. Right? But in all seriousness, right? I mean, so, and again, I'll talk for the gay male community here, cisgendered gay male community. What that said to us was that those of you that don't get married, that don't go out and do these things, are dirty, you're promiscuous, you're all of these sorts of things. So when we think about mainstream of who we are, it kind of quietens down our queerness, our radicalness. So this is why we get so much pushback on our trans brothers and sisters. This is why Mark Ames at XXL can come out with the diatribe that he did last week and banning people wearing heels, because that's meant to be normalised and mainstream. So let's be mindful and careful of that. So I'm here to say, let's shout our subcultures. Let's push that proudly out there. And as a black gay man, I'm never going to be mainstream, hun. Never. They don't want me.
Nail on the head. I think Mark's point about never being wanted by the straight community can apply to us all. Is it really equality if the condition of entry is a long list of rules that we have to follow? You've got to be a quote-unquote good gay. You've got to hold a sensible job. Don't dress too flamboyantly. Have monogamous marriage. Spend your pink pound. Don't talk about sex. And definitely don't upset the straight people. That's fine for people who want that. But when you don't want that, when you don't want to adhere to these norms, you can maybe be feel like a bad gay and still unwelcome in heterosexual society. And even like you're letting the team down. That's why I think the LGBTQ community is always going to be important, so that everybody will always be able to find some place where they fit in and belong.
I didn't want the panel to end, but we had to. Again, we handed over the microphone to the audience and allowed them to ask some questions. The first question was about protecting our pride parades and events from becoming too mainstream, too commercialised, and still retaining their queerness.
I wish I knew the answer.
pride as a concept is so charged. So when we did the campaign this year around what does pride mean to you and ultimately pride matters, it was so rich as a territory, and it was a change from last year when we had Love Happens Here, because Love Happens Here was, here you go, love happens here, make it happen. And 90% of gay men have never felt love. It's very different in the, what did you call it, people of colour? No, the non-white community. Like, it is so different. And so when we said, well, what does pride mean to you? And we ran that piece of research, AI was overwhelmed that 2,000 people within 10 days filled out a 10-minute questionnaire. Like, when we release that, people are like, I ain't going to fill in a long questionnaire, but people want to tell you. And I think we as organisers want to listen. It's how do we listen as a group of volunteers? How do we give it the depth that it needs? And what I learned from that research, having written the report around what does pride mean to you, was it does not mean one thing to more than two people. So how do you therefore create an event that can cater for that? And what was so interesting was when you took the data and then you cut it, and I always keep talking about cut, you cut it against people of colour, you cut it against asexual, people who identify as queer, pansexual, polysexual, you see the charge now of what it was like in the 70s for people who are now mainstream. And you start to think, how do you do that under one event? And how do you make that in such a way that it can self-sustain and be free, because it has to be free, and serve all of those different functions and purposes that it needs to? And then you get something like Britney at Brighton, and people say, oh my God, that's amazing, they've got Britney, isn't that amazing? And you have to go through the hype of people as volunteers feeling bad that we haven't got something as Britney, and then seeing it come out in the wash the way it did.
What Asan is referencing here is that this year, many LGBTQ people felt that Brighton Pride has entirely lost its gayness and its queerness, that had been overrun by straight people treating it as a rainbow festival who were just there to see Britney and not embrace our community and our pride at all.
You have to make your voice known in the things like the surveys, in the open meetings that we do. We know there's so much further we need to go, especially after seeing the protest group. We know that. So we can't do that as people who give up our time to do it on the sides. We need the community in here, like you say, to all come together and say, we're going to do this because this is our effing event.
The answer there is important. Yes, it is the Pride event organisers' responsibility to be as inclusive and representative as possible. But they can only do that if people turn up and get involved. I know people, friends of mine, who say, oh, I don't go to Pride because it doesn't reflect me. But you are the only person who can go and represent yourself. So show up and show what being gay or queer or LGBTQ means to you.
Although I agree with you about the commercialization of Pride events, I don't think that people should go to Pride if they don't want to. It's a long day, there's big crowds, and because mainstream Pride events have lost a lot of their political roots, it can feel like it's not important. It's vital to remember that Pride is a protest.
Absolutely. No one should go if they don't want to. But then the argument could be made that if you complain that it doesn't represent you, and yet you're given the opportunity to get involved and then don't go, can you complain?
Personally, I wouldn't go to Brighton Pride because it feels very white and it's not free. I don't want to have to pay to celebrate being a lesbian. That's not cool. I genuinely don't feel like if I went to one of their open planning meetings, my suggestions would be heard.
That's why I like that London Pride is free. I still feel a real power in taking to the street of my home and marching down the centre of that city, waving my pride flag, reminding people that, yeah, it's my city and this is my way of reclaiming it. Not just for me, but also for those tourists who see us and maybe come from countries where being out isn't acceptable or our community is more in the shadows. I like being visible. That still feels powerful and it still feels political.
The next question was about how people can find places for themselves.
Google helped me loads. And I don't think there's an excuse now to not get out there, go on Google, go on to gaysians.org, have a look, plugged it. Go to ukblackpride.co.uk, plugged it. But we are so visible now. I've just finished helping the incredible Campbell X and Kayser Rose with their tour Screening Visible. And when you watch that film, you learn about the history, you learn about our invisibility, you learn about the battle that we've been on, but we're not there anymore. We're visible in the media, we're getting more visible online, there are spaces for us. So unless you are like sat in your bedroom crying, you should be out there looking for it. There's no excuse to sit and not get on your phone. Everyone has a phone underneath their thumb. Tap in the names, tap in the websites, have a look and go and find yourself. Go out and explore.
Although Shah made a good point about Google being a great resource to find your tribe, as it were, I thought that might not be easy for someone living in a small town or village, or if they're under 18 and do not have the freedom to go out and meet people. Asad touches on this and also interacting with people in real life.
I think everyone is struggling. I don't think you wake up and you're like, boom, got my community, off I go. Like, I'm ready to go. I'm a member of Blackout, member of gaysvisions.org.
Yeah, you're going to fall out. Yeah, like, fall out UK. At some point.
Yeah, like, I don't think that ever happens. I think the beautiful thing about people is that we change and we adapt and we mould. So it could be that one day you're like, right, Iman is the group and I'm there. And that can last for a little bit. And then you go, right, I'm going to go somewhere else. And I don't think you should just sit and wait for that day to come. I think it's be open to the fact that you're on a journey. And to your point about if you're 17 in the closet, trapped in there, yes, Google, but maybe shut the browser. Like, if you're a bit scared, because that's okay as well. And I think the people who are in this room are at this phase where we're able to be in this room. And so if there's someone sat there, just I think it's realize that this is ongoing. I think everyone in this room is still struggling and finding. That's why we're here talking about it. So don't expect an answer. And maybe because we've got Google, we're expecting answers from our thumbs. And actually, we're not going to get them.
I do think we have to be mindful that there are particularly younger and, again, cisgendered or trans men who may be using dating apps to think that that's where they're going to find their community. And they are wrapped up in a community of drugs and alcohol and sex and dangerous or risky behavior. And they have no idea that another community exists. So I think that we, who are privileged and are smart or who have come out of that, have a responsibility to those younger people. I think you're absolutely right, Asad, as well, is that we are on a spectrum. So the community that I wanted at 22 is very different to the community I want at 50. Okay, so where do I find all of that? So community is always moving, it's always molding, it's always shaping. But I think that one of the things that I think I believe in really, really strongly is that food before us and by us. But a friend of mine has this amazing quote, Black Queer Women from the States. And she said, stop asking for a seat at the table. The table wasn't built for you. The table wasn't built for us, okay? So there is a certain level of building our own. What I also recognize within that is that that takes a lot. It's a lot of energy. And if you are that 17-year-old who's in their bedroom and is shit scared and is frightened of Google and can't look out, they're never going to do that. They're not going to do that at all. So again, we who are privileged to be here tonight, I'm a great believer in this. We have a responsibility to make ourselves available. So be that on social media, be that on Twitter. You might be that guy that's on Grindr and that 18-year-old hits you up. Don't lay with him. Take him out for a coffee. You know, somebody wants to know about UK Black Pride. You know, you don't necessarily have to co-opt someone to be a volunteer. I mean, that's a great thing to do. But I think it's about us looking within ourselves and saying, what can I offer back to the community? What can I help to build? I think that finally, what I'd say to that individual, if they were sitting in front of me right now, be patient, have time, enjoy building the community. It's not all about sitting down and going, oh my God, you know, HIV and racism and blah, blah, blah. It's about having a drink and having some fun and going down the pub and doing all those things and all those sorts of things. That's community as well. And we underplay that. Just get out and do it.
I thoroughly enjoyed moderating the panel, but I'd like to know your thoughts on the conversation.
What I took from what they were all saying is that the protection of, importantly, how people find their community entirely relies on more people being involved and being active and starting their own movements. My hope with that, though, is that actually once people have found their like-minded closest people,
They'll then continue to reach out to other people and start to build wider connections to reach out across the full spectrum.
Hearing Mark talk about Section 28 was very interesting. It's something I only learnt about in the most recent years. LGBTQ history has not been at the top of my agenda. I think that we need to actively do more to engage with older LGBTQ people. They would have been through experiences that we wouldn't be able to fathom. Lastly, we need to know where we're from to know where we're going.